Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. Brian will be back tomorrow. But first, is it harder or easier to have a good marriage these days? There are generally two camps when debating the strength of marriage. Those who argue that climbing divorce rates are a sign of weakened marriages, versus those who point to those divorces as a sign of greater respect for independence, especially for women. Our next guest suggests there's a third way of looking at the health of marriage today. Dr. Eli Finkel, a professor of psychology at Northwestern University, spent the past year studying different types of scholarly literature about marriage. He wrote about his reflections in the New York Times on Sunday in a piece called The All or Nothing Marriage. Dr. Finkel, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, I want you to lay this out for me, your argument. You claim that the average marriage today is weaker than the average marriage of years past, but the few best marriages are far better than marriages ever were before. Explain this.
Well, so if you look at sort of basic statistics, you look at something like the divorce rate that's hovered around 45% since the early 1980s, that's not a particularly encouraging number. And even among those marriages that are remaining intact, they're a little bit less satisfying than they were. So I would say that if you wanted to characterize the state of the average marriage in America today, it's sort of limping along or hanging in there. You know, it's not a crisis, but it's not flourishing either. But what's interesting is that the best marriages today seem to be more fulfilling than the best marriages of not only, say, 30 years ago, but really throughout the course of the history of the country. And the main reason why that is we're looking for marriages to do different things today than we did in the past, and those few marriages that can really accomplish those things are spectacularly fulfilling relative to those in the past.
Listeners, we want to hear from you on this. Do you think it's harder or easier to have a fulfilling marriage today? Tell us what you think at 212-433-WNYC. Or if you have a question for Dr. Finkel, give us a call, 212-433-9692. What's been your experience of marriage? What do you think is changing? What do you think are the factors involved in whether a marriage feels fulfilling or not in your life? Dr. Finkel, you say that what we need and expect from marriage has fundamentally changed. And you lay out three models of American marriage and how it's changed over time. You say first there was institutional marriage up until the mid-1800s, which was focused on things like agriculture, food production, and shelter. And then we entered the age of what you call the companionate marriage, which revolved around the need to be loved and to have fulfilling sex lives. Now you say we're in an age of self-expressive marriage. What do you mean by that? How is that different from looking to marriage as being a source of love and reproduction?
Yeah, I mean those three models of marriage. It was a fun voyage for me because I'm a psychology professor, and so I know a lot about the psychological processes in marriage. But it wasn't really until the last year that I'd really read up on the history of marriage, the sociology of marriage. And so, yeah, if you're comparing that middle stage of marriage, the companionate stage, where love, affection, bonding, also sexuality, those things really gained prominence as the primary functions of marriage. That's what marriage was really all about. In a large sense. And then if you go back about 50 years to the 60s, when a lot of countercultural revolution was happening, the birth control pill came out and the feminine mystique came out and the civil rights legislation. And during that era, people increasingly prized self-expression, that is, a voyage of discovery. Who are you? What is your essence? How can you become the best version of yourself? And what the sociologists and historians tell us is that since the 1960s, or over the last 50 years or so, we have continued to care about the extent to which we feel love and connection in our marriage, but we have increasingly started to care about the degree to which the marriage makes us the best version of ourselves. ourselves, the truest version of ourselves.
I have to say, Dr. Finkel, when I read your piece in the Times and your argument that the best marriages of today are better than marriages past, but the average marriage are weaker, my first feeling was like, oh my gosh, another thing I have to be super and high achieving at on top of everything else. There's a lot of pressure. So talk to me about what you say are the qualities of those best marriages. I mean, looking at data, what does it mean to have a fulfilling marriage and what kind of work does it take?
So one thing that psychologists have been pretty good about studying is this idea of expectations in marriage. Are high expectations good? Are high expectations bad? When are they good or bad? We had a different sort of question than whether people have a lot or, you know, high or low expectations, because we don't think that we initially thought that what was happening is that people's expectations were getting too high and that was a problem. But then I realized that the expectations of marriage in around 1800 were literally about things like food production and shelter and survival, and those are some pretty high expectations too. So these days we're increasingly looking for these sorts of self-fulfillment aspects of marriage. The problem is, and I agree with you, that this poses a challenge to our high-achieving era. The trickiness about looking to the marriage for help with achieving our ideal self, our voyage of self-discovery, is that you really have to have a profound understanding of each other, right? So food production in 1800 didn't require that you had profound insight into the psychological essence of your partner, right? You know, tending the farm and harvesting the crops didn't require that. And even if you look to the quintessential companionate marriage, so now you can envision a marriage from the 1950s, it surely required a deep and profound sense of love and affection to be highly successful in that era. But even then, it wasn't necessary that you were necessarily each other's soulmate in the sense of profound insight. But these days, if you're looking to your marriage to help you pursue this voyage of self-discovery, become the best version of yourself, you really need a lot of time and emotional energy to invest in the relationship itself.
We're getting some calls. John in Rockaway, you've been married 42 years. What do you think? Do you think it's harder or easier to have a fulfilling marriage today than in years past?
I think it's harder because money has such a play into the marriage. Example, my wife, our kitchen, it's 25 years old. We want to change it, renovate it. It's a $50,000 venture. Do you spend the 50 or do you live with something you're not satisfied with? Our arguments all stem from money, and we're successful college graduates, raised grandchildren, and money is always the big argument point.
Money, let's talk about that, Dr. Finkel, because you talk about socioeconomic factors in the column that was in the Sunday Review section of the New York Times, but there was a response from Hannah Rosen in Slate, who argued that in some ways your piece was shaming people for having economic difficulties and having bad marriages as a result. I mean, talk about how socioeconomic status, the difficulty of paying your bills, how does that affect marriage health?
Oh, it's crucial. I mean, and in particular, it's crucial since the early 1980s when income and wealth inequality started to skyrocket. And if you compare marriages that, you know, began in the late 1970s to marriages that began about 15 years later, you see this huge divergence such that the best educated and wealthiest Americans, the marriage seems to be flourishing. The least educated, the marriages are really in crisis. There's no debate about that. I think the debate among social scientists is why we're seeing those divergences. And there are some perspectives that suggest that poor people don't value the marriage enough. This is not Hannah Rosen's perspective, by the way, but some people that poor people don't value the institution enough, or they don't really understand in the same way that wealthier people what's important about a marriage. But we can rule out those explanations. Those explanations are empirically false. And so the way our perspective works is poor people today, like wealthy people today, are looking for a deep social connection, and they're even looking as much as wealthy people to their marriage to try to help them achieve their hopes and dreams. So the difference, you know, the poor people and wealthy people in some sense really do live in the same America, right, in the sense of what the broad cultural values are. And so what I think the difference is that's driving those socioeconomic distinctions is as all of us have gotten these psychologically oriented, fulfillment-oriented expectations of the marriage. Those require greater amounts of investment and time in the marriage and psychological resources, and they're just almost impossible. If you're working two jobs and then I'm working in the night shift and we have three young children and the pipes have broken or frozen in the house and the car needs to be repaired, how on earth are we going to muster the time and psychological energy that's going to be required for us to develop the deep understanding that we need to help facilitate each other's well-being? So Hannah Rosen and I really don't have any real disagreement there.
Listeners, we're taking your calls about marriage. Do you agree? Do you think it's harder or easier to have a fulfilling marriage today? And what are the ways you've tried to keep your marriage healthy in this time of anxiety, stresses, and economic pressures? 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Jane in Bergen County, you called in to say marriage is important and special. How do you take care of marriage, do you think?
Well, I think one of the most important components is the physical relationship. I'm 53 years old. My husband is 52. We've been married 15 years, my third marriage. The importance of really keeping that physical connection. And I thought it was interesting whether, you know, economically, you're socioeconomically high, low. But when people keep that physical and you keep in shape and you keep that love and even holding hands, I'm not just talking about, you know, having sex and all that, you know, because and understanding each other's partner's needs, I really think it's important and giving each other space and trust. So I really believe that's a big component. You have to really work on that. And when you work on it, it's great.
Jane in Bergen County, thanks so much for your call. Dr. Finkel, did you see, I mean, you heard her talking about time and away, but also space for each other, but also intimacy and feeling a sense of connection. Did you see when people talked about their level of satisfaction with marriages, did it change for people who had young children who were dealing with, you know, intense parenting responsibilities versus those that didn't?
Yes, as a man with two young children and whose son was screaming from 3 to 5 a.m. this morning, yes, the evidence is stark on this point, that having young children tends to be linked to lower marital satisfaction. I should say, on the upside, being a grandparent appears to be one of the best roles going. So the lesson, I think, is maybe skip parenting and just become a grandparent.
Jennifer in Manhattan, you have a question for Dr. Finkel. What's your question?
Yes, I'm curious about his position on what has long been seen as the kind of gender divide on marital satisfaction. The view has been held that women tend to need a very satisfying marriage to be happy and to find it, you know, fulfilling and meaningful, whereas for men, just being married bestows upon them, you know, better satisfaction, health, and well-being.
Dr. Finkel, did you see a gender breakdown in terms of the way people defined marital satisfaction?
Yeah, the listener is right. It looks like marriage tends to be generally healthy for people. You know, it's hard to do the perfect study because you can't randomly assign people to be married or divorced or anything like that. But the evidence is, to my mind, pretty good that marriage is, on average, good for people. The evidence is also pretty good that, on average, marriage is better for men than for women. I think there are several reasons why that's the case. One of the more interesting reasons why you see the gender difference is women tend to have more intimate companions than men do. So women with their, say, for example, their sister or their close college friend they've kept in touch with over the years tend to have sort of deeper emotionally connective relationships than men do on average. And what that means is that the man is more dependent upon his spouse for all sorts of social and emotional needs than a woman is on her husband, because she has a larger pool of people she can turn to. I think that's one of the reasons why you see that even though women often feel a greater amount of pressure to be married, that once people are married, men often reap a larger benefit of being married.
Because women have more emotional options, you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's one major reason why you see the sex difference, yes.
Stephen in Baskin Ridge, New Jersey, what do you want to add to this conversation?
Well, I believe I've been married for almost 25 years, and I believe that the success of a marriage really is based on the expectations you bring into the marriage in the first place and the expectations you have throughout. And if you have unreasonable expectations, you're going to have a tough time remaining married. But if you have reasonable expectations, both partners, I think you stand a very good chance.
Stephen, I'm going to put you a bit on the spot, but how would you describe the objective of a marriage for you? Like, how? What was the expectation for you?
You know, my expectations were relatively simple. I mean, they were based in reality. I didn't expect to go into my marriage, you know, having, you know, fireworks every night and, you know, perfect children and, you know, no monetary worries. I expected to have certain issues. I expected to every once in a while maybe have money problems. I expected, you know, there to be fights or arguments every once in a while. I expected my wife and I not to agree on everything. So, you know, I hope and I think I was pretty realistic in my expectations. And the upside of all that is that if you get something better than your expectations, it's like, you know, a kid in a candy store.
Stephen, so, thank you so much for your call. Randy, in Manhattan, you bring up caregiving and health and marriage. Tell me about your
marriage. I've been with my husband for 36 years. We adore each other, but your guest has it backwards for us. Yes, my husband now is developing more intimate relationships, which really thrills me, outside of the marriage, because he's become almost a prisoner, and it breaks my heart because I have Parkinson's.
Thank you for your call.
And he has become more of a caregiver than a husband.
Thank you for your call, Randy. Talk about aging in marriage, Dr. Finkel. Dealing with health issues, dealing with when you're together a long time, your relationship to each other changes. Does that affect what you see in terms of how people describe their fulfillment with their marriage?
You know, we didn't focus as much on that, but there's no doubt that people face a broad range of different stressors in their marriages. And, you know, one of the lessons that I think comes not specifically from the work we did, but from life more generally, is you can get married at 27, and the next year somebody gets MS or cancer, and it happens when people, you're more likely to have a long-term health ailment when people age, or somebody gets hit by a car or something like that. So, I mean, I guess I would say one of the major lessons for those cases is look, marriage, it really can be sacred and special, and a lot of us get distracted by the sleepless nights and the toilet seat being up or down, and you know, there's opportunities to savor each other and opportunities to facilitate your partner's well-being and to provide love and support. And in a case like the most recent callers, it seems like that's a major source of emphasis that can be healthy for both parties.
Randy in Manhattan, thanks again for your call. And Dr. Finkel, before I let you go, when you talk about taking care of a marriage and what it requires to be a better than average marriage, concretely, what are some things that you notice talking to couples about things that make you feel more connected and fulfilled in a marriage?
Well, there's a broad range of options, but the major thing that concerns me is the imbalance between what people are looking for the marriage to fulfill and the amount they are willing or able to invest in the marriage per se. The listener who preceded the caller, you know, talked about how he has realistic expectations, and what I would say is let's all try for the optimal marriage. And what that means in a very practical way is we really look to bring out the best in each other, not just to make each other feel loved, but to see in your spouse, to see in your spouse the version of himself, the version of herself that he or she dreams of becoming, and then think of ways that you might help to facilitate that, and hopefully your spouse will do that for you. What I would say is, and this might be where I differ from a lot of social scientists, perhaps even Hannah Rosen, is I would say that some marriages, either through compatibility issues or through poverty-related issues, aren't in a position to meet those extremely time-intensive or psychologically intensive expectations. And for those people, I recommend a pretty good plan B, which is try to calibrate the expectations you're bringing to the marriage to the resources that you're able to spend in the marriage right now. So if you have young children at home and you're working three jobs, now probably isn't the time to be hoping that your partner can talk to you for several hours a day about your personal voyage. But put in your back pocket that we'll do that one day, and for now, for the next year, let's focus on mutual respect, mutual affection, being good parents together, and that's a pretty good plan B.
Dr. Eli Finkel is a professor of psychology at Northwestern University. His piece, The All or Nothing Marriage, was in the Sunday Review section of Sunday's New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we had a lot of great calls on the last topic. Thanks for sharing your stories with us. One of our listeners, Peter from Glen Ridge, says the secret to a happy marriage is both being members of WNYC. Maybe that works for you. I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehrer.